Tim, do you have your blurb for the beginning of the show?
Yeah. Okay.
It's okay. I'm bad at improv too.
I'm like, wait, are we starting or are we starting?
Oh yeah, like I'm ready. Do you have your blurb for the beginning?
Yeah, I can go right into it. Have you seen this? Molly Shannon and Will Ferrell star in one of SNL.
Wait a minute.
What?
Did you watch the SNL movie?
Yeah, of course. Why?
Okay, you know we were supposed to watch the Todd Haynes experimental art film with the Barbie dolls, right?
Oh, God damn it. I'll be right back.
Welcome to Have You Seen This?
The world's only podcast about obscure, overlooked, and misbegotten media.
All discussions will be spoiler heavy.
You have been warned.
This show would not be possible without the support of our patrons. If you would like to support our show, join us at patreon.com/haveyouseenthis. For just $5 a month, get access to our Discord and all 3 episodes every month covering movies you've never heard of, or maybe wish you hadn't.
Now, I was mistaken. We are, of course, reviewing the Barbie movie for this episode.
You know what? That's close enough. Why don't you take 5? I'll just talk for a while, Tim.
Sure.
And maybe take your meds, too.
Look, you said we're watching Superstar, a movie about Barbies, and I think that was pretty obvious. I did the assignment.
Tim understood the assignment. Well, technically, Tim.
Yeah?
They weren't really Barbies. They were knockoffs, which is why Todd Haynes was actually able to stave off a lawsuit from the Mattel Corporation. I bet you didn't know that.
I didn't know that. And I bet that our listeners don't know that we're actually reviewing Todd Haynes' movie Superstar about Karen Carpenter.
Yeah, this is an early film that Todd Haynes made when he was pursuing his MFA at Bard College. He made it with his friend, Cynthia Snyder, who helped him with the script. She's actually thanked in the credits of a few of his later movies, including his most recent one, May December, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I think she's a lawyer now. And
good, she got out of it.
Yeah, speaking of lawyering, this was a movie that had a little bit of a problematic release, to say the least. Full title is Superstar, the Karen Carpenter Story. It was shown around a few festivals, but that came to an abrupt halt in 1990 because Richard Carpenter was not exactly thrilled with the depiction of his family. The story was that, Todd Haynes didn't get the rights to these Carpenter songs that he put in the movie. But when you watch it, you're like, yeah, I can see how the Carpenter family would, the surviving members would not exactly be pleased with their portrayal, however accurate or inaccurate it may be.
Right. And I don't know a lot about the Carpenters, but just the portrayal of it, I don't know if I should, just release my final statement on this. I understand it was when he was doing an MFA, and that's not when anyone's doing their best work, it's their first work. But apart from the inspired conceit of telling the story with Barbies, or with, you know, Barbie-like knockoff brand dolls, it's not a well-told documentary that is kind of melodramatic and covers anything relevant with title cards.
Okay, so you didn't care for the movie?
No, for reasons I just described.
Right. Okay, sorry, folks, it's going to be one of those episodes, but bear with us. We can squeeze something
all right
out of this.
Change my mind, Jen.
Do people know about the Carpenters these days? Do we have to contextualize?
Only ironically.
I guess so. I would say less ironically as time goes on, because they were so ubiquitous in the charts in the early part of the 70s. They kind of were the musical establishment, and a lot of hay is made from that in this film, because Haynes spends a lot of time kind of contextualizing the Carpenters with America, basically, in a time of Nixon and Vietnam and malaise and turmoil and all that bullshit. You had this nice music for nice people made by a couple of nice kids from Downey, California. You notice how, like, so many, like, great American bands have come out of some of the worst, like, Los Angeles suburbs. Like, the Beach Boys came from fucking Hawthorne. Have you been to Hawthorne?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, it sucks. And the Carpenters
right.
grew up in Downey, and they're probably Downey's most famous citizens, for better or for worse.
I would assume so, yeah.
Do you know their music very well, Tim?
I remember hearing the Carpenters in, like, Tommy Boy and Deadpool, so I'm going to say no.
Well, there's that irony that you were talking about.
That's what I'm saying. I may not be the person to generalize from, but there you have it.
I think that, as I said, the Carpenters' reputation has grown with time and distance. Like a lot of things that we talk about on the show, I think when they were actually around, mm-hmm. because they were chart sensations that were also very nice, tastefully arranged, inoffensive music.
Nice music for nice people, yes.
Yeah, it was something for the counterculture to kind of push against, and you didn't want to admit that you liked them. And there had to be like a wink if you said, like, oh, well, you know, like, yeah, they, you know, they suck, but, you know, Karen Carpenter is a great voice, though. Like, she's great. Or whatever.
Yeah, it's like, I hate the Carpenters, but they're good musicians.
Yeah, it's a very qualified sort of praise.
Right, in the way that we'll say, this is a good performance in this shitty movie.
Yeah, and as they kind of fall out of phase with their cultural context, it's more the kind of thing that you can just be like, oh, yeah, I like this music. It's good. You know, obviously you have Karen, who was one of the great alto pop singers, and her brother, who was a peerless arranger of music and was raised from an early age as a musical genius. He was almost cultivated at the expense of his sister for quite a while, which kind of led to this story.
Just a couple of child prodigy musicians.
Right. And so with time and distance, people are like, oh yeah, the Carpenters are actually good. I did a little bit of a crash course because I'd seen this film before, and I knew the outlines of the Karen Carpenter story, which is a very tragic one. And I realized I wasn't that familiar with their music, so I took a little stroll through their catalog. And, you know, it's not the worst thing. It's not the kind of music that I would listen to on a regular basis, but it has its pleasures. And I do think that Karen Carpenter's voice kind of elevates material that would otherwise be too syrupy, just because she's such a great vocalist.
Yeah.
I did think today when I got in the car to go somewhere and, you know, Carpenter's greatest hits or whatever came up on my phone, I was like, okay, like, I seriously can't. I need to listen to, like, the opposite of the Carpenters right now, because I've been listening to them for, like, 2 days straight.
The Coopers?
So I put on RBL Posse.
I know.
That worked.
Okay, yeah, that'll do.
Yeah. It's pleasant music, and I understand why people like it and why it was so popular. But I guess the reason that this film has had such a lively cult existence, because it has been so widely bootlegged, is because it's a somewhat unvarnished telling of this rather sordid story, which is the sad story of Karen Carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's it, folks. We're done.
All right, great.
Now, I should apologize to you, Tim, because the copy that I sent you was, like, pretty shitty.
Yeah, I found the other one on archive.org, which is the repository for media that is of an artistic but not commercial value.
Yes, because I don't know. I guess search engines are even shittier than I thought at this point in time because I was like, what the hell? It's not on archive.org. Like, what the hell? And then I found it like today and I was like, oh, God damn it.
Right. Yeah. I also found a Gaspar Noé interview that I'll watch after this.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. Back on task. Yeah. I don't have much context for the Carpenters other than like ironic usage in a sort of postmodern sense. What I get from their story and what I was able to piece together, Jen, you're saying that they're, it is counterculture. I guess it's mainstream culture. It's nice music for nice people at a time when the direction of, rock and roll is, Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and The Who and the like. Whereas this is like, can't we all just listen to nice, pleasant songs of a woman singing pleasantly? And I think that a lot of the Carpenters' cachet came from the cultural context in which they existed, where, like that documentary that you sent me, we have, Nixon being impeached, we have Vietnam, we have protests, we have assassinations, we have a lot of cultural strife. And I think that mirrors the situation today where people are like, can't we just go back to happier, simpler, more normalized times where, every white family is rich and secure and lives in the suburbs. And I think that it's, people panicking and reacting to the current turmoil, whether it's the 70s or whether it's today, where they're just like, just give me something like I just want to live on a farm and not carry that the world is being boiled alive and, we could die at any moment or just, be killed by a random armed lunatic. Like, I just want to live on a farm and like feed goats and make dinner and, just like hang out and pretend that no one else is around. Like, it's that, kind of before tradwife was a word, like, we had the Carpenters.
I think that's a really good way of framing it. And I think on the flip side, the reason why the story resonates is because you have that shiny surface. What lies underneath it is kind of like, it's kind of like the beginning of a Blue Velvet, when you like kind of pan down into the lawn and it's just like crawling with bugs.
Yeah, it's more seedy than you might think because you've been willfully ignorant or sold a bill of goods to be like, no, this is the way normal things are. But it's like, well, this is all an act. This is all drag. This is kayfabe, whatever you want to call it. And I think the Carpenters are part of that. They have their cultivated, squeaky clean image of, a nice brother and sister who make nice music for nice people. And the thing that I was able to grab onto about it reminded me a lot of Joy Division. And hey, happy music. It's got joy right in the title. which at the time, they're like, 23 or whatever, and they're just touring relentlessly. And Ian's seizures are getting worse because they're always on the road and they're always stressing and working and running themselves ragged because it's like, well, I guess this is what you got to do to make it. And they did. And it only cost Ian Curtis's life. And I feel it's the same story with Karen Carpenter, where it's like things are going great. We're performing at the White House. We're winning Grammys. We're getting the respect of legends in our own time.
We're on top of the world, looking down on creation.
Right. Yeah. That's really well put, Jen. write that one down. Yeah. So it's all these great things are happening, but it's like those things all come with a price, and that price is Karen Carpenter's mental health, basically. It's the two of them where in order to keep up this facade, this persona, there's all this other work that goes on in the background. And I think that is the intangible antagonist that I think that Todd Haynes' MFA documentary isn't aware of. I think that it manifests in difficult people in their life, but it's not the individuals, it's the context of the lifestyle that Karen Carpenter was in, and that is what drove her to being the way that, to her ultimate fate of death by
Ipecac.
Anorexia. Yeah, anorexia-related complications. All right, so I'm done. You can talk for 40 minutes.
Which is about the length of the film itself.
Right, yeah. This is an easy watch. So even if you don't like it, it's like, whatever.
It's interesting because, like I said, I had seen this a few times before. I really like the conceit.
Yes.
I like that it's academic and sort of pretentious. I like Haynes' use of montage, which can be quite shocking in parts. The way that he uses ephemera of the time, often contrasted with shock footage. I think the voice acting is quite good for what it is.
Okay, and I'm gonna disagree, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I think it is kind of like voice acting never quite sounds right to me because it's divorced from kind of a physical context beyond like the recording booth. But I think they did a credible job considering they were playing with Barbies.
Yeah, I think the sound in this needed a lot of work. But again, it's a student film. What do you want?
Well, yeah, it's whatever they checked out from the from what the school had on hand.
Yeah, like there isn't any other kind of like atmospheric sound. It's like you get the feeling this is a voice actor reading this in a booth.
Yeah.
In isolation. And then it's cut together. And like it really feels that way.
It is what it is. But I was listing the things that I do like about the movie. For whatever reason, I love a brick of mostly illegible academic text over bland, ephemeral stock footage read dispassionately about a shocking or upsetting topic. I don't know why I enjoy that kind of thing, but maybe I am the kind of person that this sort of movie is made for, because I do get what he was putting across. It's a burlesque on, I don't want to say that. It's a take on corny biopics about pop singers, you know, the cost of like making it to the top. By the way, going off what Tim said earlier, check out Control, directed by Anton Corbijn. Very good film.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of a sly pastiche of cheesy biopics and whatnot, but there is that seedy underbelly to it. And I think Haynes does a good job at getting to the real sickness at the core of America, which is the nuclear family. It comes out through the film when you start to understand like how much Karen was controlled by the people around her, particularly her mother. And in researching for this episode, it's apparent from reading about her that Karen's mom, Agnes, was not a chill person. She was extremely controlling. She had her hooks pretty deep in her daughter. And I think that was a major contributor to the exacerbation of her eating disorder. She was trying to claw back some form of control. And
speaking of,
Todd Haynes gets right to the heart of that. And through the medium of like Barbie dolls, like what's more American than fucking Barbie, you know?
Yeah, it is a female role model that it's understood girls aspire to. So it's, you know, it's this unreal, it's this unattainable paragon. And in that way, you know, Karen Carpenter is kind of in that same situation where it's like, I have to project this image of this kind of person that my audience assumes I am, even though, you know, I'm not that. And I'm more and less than that.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, because like, yeah, there's more to her than just the persona that the audience understands, but also no other person, I suppose with the exception of Taylor Swift, apparently, is really like that, is like the person that they purport to be through their art or on stage. Now I gotta disagree with you, Jen, about the you know, efficacy of the movie, because I feel like a lot of it is, you know, we have these, you know, like you say, this bold conceit of telling a story with Barbies, and then the narrative stops to present a title card to be like, okay, here's everything that we are actually trying to say, because it turns out that telling a story with dolls isn't really effective. So let me just get you caught up real quick, then we'll go back to the other thing where it's a close-up of a lump of inert plastic trying to stand in as the multiple internal psychological struggles of this tortured person. And then when that doesn't work, we'll put up another title card.
There was a thing that struck me as I was watching it, because the whole conceit of using the dolls, to my mind, was basically like, oh, it's a way to tell a story that you in no way have the resources or the budget to tell. Because in in miniature, you can replicate a well-appointed middle-class living room in Downey, California, when you're going to school across the country, or a hospital,
a fancy party in Culver Century City,
which is like the and that scene. Like, he does okay with in the spirit of, have you seen this? Doing what you can with what you have.
Exactly, yeah.
It is very nicely set up, that shot of Karen when she's finally moved out. She's got her apartment in Century City. She's throwing a really great grown-up party, and Dionne Warwick is there, and it's just so amazing. And there's, like, this panning
all
shot.
All her psychic friends.
That follows her. And it's like, hey, you know, like, the production design, my compliments.
yeah. It's one of our greatest entries in pre-visualization.
That's a really good word, because that's also how it strikes me a lot of the time watching it, is it's like pre-vis. It's like, okay, like, I can't draw too well, so let me show you what I kind of want to do with the dolls.
Right, yeah. Once we're able to rent a dolly, then I'll show you this is the shot that I had in mind.
Yeah, and maybe the movie was helped along by the kind of camp factor of being told with dolls, because it is absurd. It like these very cliched musical montages set to Carpenter's music with the dolls kind of moving in front of the camera like this, to be like, yeah, they're walking.
Yeah, it's cliched and contrived, much like trying to be a musical act in, you know, counterculture rock and roll in the 70s and telling everyone, hey, everything's going to be all right.
Yeah. And you, at the same time, are very much not all right. And your brother needs to go to rehab for pills. And your dad just straight up doesn't talk because your mom doesn't let him get a word in edgewise, like, ever.
Right.
And you really want to be married and have kids. You want that more than anything in the world, but you can't find the right guy. And the guy you do end up marrying tells you a few days before you are going to get married, oh, by the way, that whole thing about having kids, I had a vasectomy.
Cool. Yeah. So, maybe, you know, life is only like, you know, a fairy tale in movies.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm going to blow some 20-year-old's mind with that one.
Now, another thing that hit me while I was watching this, because I was like, you know, to be fair to Tim, as much as this is kind of an experimental art film, which is a thing that is his bag, I don't know if he's as into this particular brand of pop culture and camp, but it occurred to me that Karen Carpenter was, in a way, overshadowed by her brother, because her mother in particular believed him to be a musical genius, and she basically put all her energy into cultivating him at, like, Karen's
expense. Yeah, he's the golden boy.
Yeah, he was the golden child. She didn't, and I don't think, for Karen, it was really hard to come forward and be the group singer. Like, it wasn't that she wanted to be the center of attention. She just wanted her mother's love. and just could not get it no matter what. I mean, what she got out of Agnes was basically suffocating. But I was like, wait a minute. Perhaps this is something that a middle child could relate to, being the overlooked child.
I mean, I think that the situation for Karen, as I understand it, is she was good at something but didn't feel motivated to do that thing. It's like, I just want to play my drums. So it's like, well, play drums in this band. Okay, now we're really popular. It's like, okay, well, I'll play drums in the really popular band. It's like, no, well, you're actually good at singing. Why don't you sing too? It's like, okay, like, I really like doing this stuff, but I don't like doing it in this context. And that, you know, that was the, you know, one of the things that I learned about is, like, you know, she can go to rehab and she can get, she can deal with her anorexia, but I think, well, my interpretation of it is that anorexia is a manifestation of the stress of doing these things that she would normally like doing, but in a context that is really stressful for her. And as long as she's doing that, she's going to have anorexia as her only coping mechanism. It's the surest way to lose interest in your hobbies is to try to monetize them. And I think that's my takeaway in all this of, you know, the tragedy of Karen Carpenter, is that she had things that she enjoyed doing that she was fantastic at. And it's like, okay, well, you are now obligated to make that your line of work, and you have to maintain an image that goes along with that. You can't just do these things for fun or because you like them. This is your job now. And you're like, fuck, this isn't what I signed up for. Like, I don't like doing this. I did this because these were things that I enjoyed and was good at. But it's like, well, if you let the mask slip at any point, you're losing your livelihood. So now I got that to worry about. And more than like an overbearing mother or any of the other things that she wanted out of life, I think that that's the crux of it. That's the cause of her issues is, and with my bachelor's in psychology.
Hey, everybody's got to start somewhere.
Yeah, someone that I don't know anything about other than an MFA documentary. But yeah, I think that, you know, she's just caught in the wrong lifestyle, and the anorexia is a manifestation of that. And true to her fate, as long as she was in that, she wasn't going to be cured of anorexia, because it was an emergent response for an entirely too stressful lifestyle that was basically ruining the thing that she, that she liked doing. So that's my takeaway from it. The mother thing figures into it. lack of any other sort of support beyond, her brother, who is also her coworker.
Yeah.
He's the support, but he's also kind of part of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another really good point. And you can see why he was so mad about the film, because he is villainized in this. I do think it might be a little unfair, because, he was also a young person thrust into the spotlight and had to deal with an addiction to Quaaludes, and also, like, he was a part of this family too, which had this like whole fucked up dynamic. And I believe that he really did love his sister. He really did care for her. In the movie, he's almost like a two-dimensional villain, because whenever he's screaming at her, it's like, are you trying to ruin both our careers or something like that, which...
Yeah, that's the part of the issue that I take with the Todd Haynes movie. Also, as an aside, I think your mention of Richard on Quaaludes is... I feel like the Carpenters are culturally kind of a Quaalude, 70s being appropriate.
Yeah, especially if you like, listen to their like rock and roll covers.
Yeah.
Like listen to their cover of Please, Mr. Postman.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, like, this is nice, but you pressed all the rock and roll out of it.
All the unpleasantness, Jennifer.
Right. All the
yeah.
pelvic motions, basically.
Mm-hmm. All the bad thoughts, all the things that lead to that lead to protests and birth control and just awful things in society.
All the marijuana that smoke.
Yeah, all the marijuana. but yeah, that I think again contextualizes the Carpenters as like all this bullshit going on in society at the time. And it's like I just am in, the U.S. being in denial about how at odds it is with itself, how stressed out and, living wrongly it is. Where it's like, just give me this Carpenter's Quaalude and I can pretend everything's all right.
Especially when you look at how really rotten to the core the culture was and is.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Gemini Man, in the 70s.
Speaking of malaise.
Right, yeah.
That movie will make you want to overdose on Quaaludes. But interestingly, do you know who gave Richard the Quaaludes in the first place?
Andy Dick. I'm gonna assume.
Yeah, after he tried to grab his crotch. No, it was his mother.
Okay, well, that's...
And she was like, hey, these really help me relax and get to sleep. Apparently she took a fucking Quaalude, like, every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Until...
Mother's a Little Helper.
Yeah.
Maybe they should write a song about that.
Yeah.
Or is that too real, man?
And I guess it worked for her, but it didn't make her less of an uptight, controlling person.
Mm-hmm.
But, do? Like, there are things drugs can't cure.
Right, yeah, you can call it generational trauma, too, where it is, mm-hmm. For whatever wrong reasons that, the Carpenter's parents got together and, her mother found her own pharmaceutical coping mechanism, and it's like, well, this works for me, why don't you just do more drugs?
Right, but the right kind of drugs.
Right, yeah, the ones that you can get a prescription for, it's fine.
Not the kind that colored people do.
Right, not the illegal drugs, just the legal ones, the ones that are moral and correct.
Yeah, another tidbit that I learned about the Carpenter's mom is that apparently she was like hella anti-Semitic. And it used to embarrass the hell out of Karen because she had one of her closest friends and confidants was a socialite.
Was Anne Frank.
It was a socialite who was Jewish.
Right.
And she was, like, every time her friend came over and her mom would, like, start in, she would be like, oh, my God, like, this is so fucking embarrassing. I was like, that's a hell of a thing. Also, she liked to drop the N-word.
Wow.
Yeah. Her mom was super, super chill.
Yeah, really mother dearest, mm-hmm. mommy dearest kind of vibes.
And I think that's what I enjoy about stories like this, because it is a familiar milieu to me. And in fact,
mm-hmm.
as most people who listen to the show know, I grew up in Thousand Oaks, California, which...
Even worse than Downey.
Well, I believe it is, to this day, the residence of Richard Carpenter and family.
Ah.
The name of him and his... of Richard Carpenter and wife is on the Civics Arts Plaza in town.
Good. Good for them.
Karen is, in fact, buried in Westlake Village, very nearby. Formerly, she was buried in a different cemetery, but for whatever reason, Richard had her and her parents moved and interred in Westlake. I guess maybe because he wanted them to be close to his family.
Close to you.
Ah, there you go.
I get it.
It's darkly appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So because I am very familiar with this particular kind of curdled middle class existence, I love seeing
your favorite.
The cracks in it.
Yeah.
It's very familiar to me. And in spite of the fact that as fucked up as I am, I got out of my adolescence and into adulthood without any kind of eating disorder, which is amazing considering how many people I know with either in recovery from an eating disorder or possibly still grappling with one.
Right. Yeah, times are tough all around.
Yeah. Anyway, you want to get ice cream after this?
Well, if you finish the one you have right now first.
Tim and I like to enable each other.
You can't go two-fisting ice creams. Like, you can't go through life that way. You'll never become a famous pop musician like that.
Nobody stopped me yet, Tim.
It's going to be you that stops you. That's the thing. And intrinsic to the Karen Carpenter story, you know, it is her being blind to, you know, her own failings, you know, the compromises and the you know, sort of devil's bargains that she's had to make, you know, in exchange for success. I think that she lives a particular lifestyle that has these dark areas associated with it that she's never going to get out of as long as she maintains that lifestyle. The documentary, I think, you know, like you say, Janet, paints a really flat picture of her brother Richard because, it's like pretty much every other scene he's like yelling at her when, I mean, I can't say that I have any special knowledge because my only understanding of, you know, Richard Carpenter is the very cultivated, inoffensive image that he has. So then to see him portrayed as the shouting abusive brother in this entire documentary, I'm like, well, that doesn't ring true. But then again, it's like I'm dealing with two potentially contrived narratives in this point where it's like neither of them could be true, or they could both be true to an extent. But in that, it seems like a lot of the abuse that Karen suffers is from her mom and from her brother. But I think that is personifying this situational malaise that ultimately led to her expressing her discontent through anorexia.
You make a good point because I feel like, in a way, maybe Richard is sort of a stand-in for the music industry side of her life. There is kind of a shadowy, satanic A&M president. I don't know if that's supposed to be Herb Alpert. I don't know if Herb Alpert is actually demonic. You wouldn't think that listening to him and the Tijuana Brass, but there you go.
Right. Yeah, or like Burt Bacharach, you know, noted Satanist.
Well, just ask like Angie Dickinson.
Right, yeah, fair enough. I don't know. I don't know what gets on in these parties.
But kind of my take on the whole characterization of Richard is that I'm sure that he probably did yell at her a lot, but possibly in that way that you lose patience when someone that you love very much is destroying themselves. And particularly because at the time, I mean, Karen Carpenter was kind of she brought the awakening of the American consciousness to disordered eating in a big way. She died when she was 32. It made headlines.
Right.
And people were like, how the hell did you die at 32 from not eating? There was very little understanding of the disease at the time. The doctor that she, well, I don't think he was actually a doctor. The therapist that she was seeing at the time, Stephen Levenkron, who's pretty much like the authority on anorexia, even though the disease had been known possibly at least since the mid-1800s, possibly in the 1600s, maybe even farther back than that, just without kind of a medical definition.
Yeah, because the 1800s, that's when they invented the female orgasm, right?
Oh, Tim, that isn't real.
Well, I mean, contrived,
I guess. Right. Yeah.
To explain hysteria.
Yeah, you do your own research, everyone.
It's a controversial topic.
But what was I saying about anorexia?
You're talking about her doctor.
Oh, because, you know, he was like the one authority on it. The public didn't really know about this disorder. And certainly to the people around her who were close to her, it must have just looked absolutely deranged, and in a way it is. And I don't have a lot of experience personally with disordered eating, but you can imagine if somebody that you know is wasting away in front of you, the yeah. question that you ask is like, just why don't you just fucking eat something? Like, get over it and eat. And I'm sure that right. Karen got a lot of that. And maybe if her brother yelled at her, it was because he was scared. And she did look ill. I mean, there yeah. was a point in their onstage career when she would come out on stage and the audience would gasp because she right. was so thin.
Yeah.
Like, people knew yeah, something like, was that really wrong. Look healthy.
Right. It's like, do you have cancer?
Yeah. And in fact, when they went over to the UK, and an interviewer, I think there was footage of it in the documentary that I sent you, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
An interviewer actually confronted Karen and asked her, like, you know, there people have been saying that you are suffering from, as she called it, the Slimmer's disease, anorexia, and you got down to like, you know, 6 stone or whatever. And Karen kind right. of parries it by saying, well, I don't know what stones are, you know, and then just yeah. flatly denies that she has the eating disorder that she very obviously has.
Clearly is manifesting, yeah.
Yeah. And
well, that kind of sounds like, you know, body dysmorphia. Like, people yes. around you are like, geez, this looks awful. But meanwhile, you're like, I'm in control. I'm doing this. I'm able to, you know, dictate what my body does and doesn't do. And I'm able to achieve the results that I want, and not seeing that, yeah, they're wasting away. You know, they're turning into, you know, like a Holocaust victim, which, you know, Haynes invokes in some of his montage, where it's like, you're just wasting away to like skin and bones.
And I do want to bring that up because it is something that has bothered me about the film since I saw it. And I don't, to this day, I still don't know where I stand on that bit of footage, because it is very shocking. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's just unforgivably tasteless or not.
Well, he explains it later in one of the many title cards used to patch over the ineffective Barbie scenes, which he has in between another you know, serene setting of you know, Carpenter's music over a Barbie doll standing on a little cardboard stage with lights and stuff. It has a title card that explains what anorexia is, and it's saying that the person suffering is both the fascist and the victim. They're the one imposing this this austerity on themselves. So, you know, there's fascism and the victim in there. And I think, you know, Todd Haynes just saw fascism and like circled that in the book, and it's like, let me go through my card catalog and the university's media library.
Hey, we watched
footage I can use.
We watched Night and Fog in our seminar a couple of weeks ago. Like, maybe I can get a copy of that, you know, splice that in.
Yeah. So, I mean, visually it's an easy touchstone to be like, you're wasting away under your own boot heel, basically.
Yeah, and I understand.
I believe that's his justification. It doesn't go any further than that.
No, I think you're correct, because the word fascism is dropped in the film, and like, what better distillation of fascism than its horrifying ultimate end? You know what mm-hmm. what happened in Europe, but it seems so histrionic to me, and histrionic film, and I don't know uh-huh. if I'm also just kind of saying like, oh well, like the Holocaust, that's a boundary that you absolutely can't cross. You can't
red line.
That, and I don't really right. believe that.
Right.
I think
now if they had turned the XX logo into a swastika, that would have been a little much.
Damn, that's, you know, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Let's send that to Adbusters. Are they still around?
Maybe, sure. I don't know. I think there's like, what, Gerald Scarfe like looking at the dailies for the wall and being like, no, I think that would be too much. Let me draw more hammers.
I guess, you know, like, it's just hitting me now, Tim. Like, I think America is just...
The Quaaludes hitting you?
I wish. You got to go to, like, South Africa to get that shit. Mm. America always seems to be just a breath away from fascism.
Americans love a good fascist. And I've watched a lot of Drunk History, and I'm like, we're just a bunch of shallow, lazy, insular idiots.
Yeah, like, there's a shot that really stays with me in the film, and it's not from any of the Barbie footage. It's this kind of serenely slowed down series of slow pans over well-stocked grocery shelves. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of this discourse about post-war America after a period of deprivation and kind of the cornucopia of plenty that America was presented with in the 1950s. And Karen Carpenter was born in 1950. Like, the bountifulness of American culture, and yet you have a main character who is denying herself, like, a part of that. Like, she's not allowing herself to partake in any of that.
Yeah, she's essential services. She's part of the machine.
Yeah, and...
You know, she's there to make other people happy, but it's like, well, it's not going to be you, though, hon.
Right, which, and speaking of American archetypes, American womanhood, particularly in the 70s. And yes, it was a time of second wave feminism, but also like a time of significant pushback to that. It's kind of like how if you go back and look at something as quote unquote innocuous as humorous postcards about suffragettes, and a lot of them are just like, oh, it's going to be so funny when men are doing all the household chores and the woman's going to go to work. And it's like, yeah, it's because that happened after women got the vote. You notice how that's totally happening right now? Men are shouldering the bulk of household labor. But some of them are like really fucking violent. Like,
yeah.
I remember.
Well, that's poor satire, isn't it? Where it's just like, we're just seeing you expressing your bile. You're doing a Garrison? Who's that guy?
Garrison Keillor?
No.
Oh, Ben, no, Ben Garrison.
Garrison Keillor. That was the name I was trying to remember from three episodes ago.
Oh, I don't even remember what movie that was.
Well, now you know.
It was A Prairie Home Companion. No, it wasn't.
Yeah. Oh, thank God I finally remembered.
But like the.
But yeah, it's Ben Garrison, where it's just it isn't a funny satire where you're like, huh, ladies, huh? It's like, wow, this person really has a problem with women.
Right. Like, I remember one distinctly where it was a suffragette who was, of course, hideously ugly because, you know, feminist equals ugly.
Only ugly women want things. Yeah.
And like she was being like compressed into like some kind of like wooden contraption.
Okay.
And it was like, oh, like you want women to suffer and die instead of voting.
Yeah, the suffering is the point.
Yeah, like that's super, super chill.
Right.
And it is funny that a lot of times when people will argue against feminist ideas, they'll be like, well, you know, I like the old kind of feminism where, you know, women just wanted to like be able to work and to vote and stuff like that, not like this new stuff. And it's like, no, you would have had a problem with the original item too. Like, you would have 100% been against that.
I don't like this new Helter Skelter Beatles music. I want to listen to a pleasant song about being close to someone. I don't want to turn on the radio and be thinking about the race war coming, and I just want a song about being a superstar.
Yeah. Yeah, and
that's why people in difficult times during the Iraq war turned to Smash Mouth to console them.
God, what a stupid, stupid decade.
Hey, now.
And are we talking about the 2000s or the 70s? Who knows?
Right, yeah. It's cyclical.
Yeah.
And Jen's like, it's sick, all right.
Well, it's like that Matt Chrisman tweet where it's like, this is the stupidest day in American history to then be immediately superseded by every other day that follows.
Stiff competition, yes.
Yeah. But anyway, like the point that I was getting to is that as much as Karen Carpenter sort of represented this idealized girl, nice girl next door womanhood, there was a tremendous amount of pain underneath it. And I think that's partially what Haynes is getting at with like some of the imagery in this film, not just the usage of Barbie, these kind of pleasant plastic dolls, but there's also some weird creepy shit that comes out. Like in particular, like in a montage near the end, there is a doll spanking another doll.
Yeah, which I'm like, whatever. This is all contrived from Todd's just need for narrative connecting tissue.
Sure. I think it's explicitly meant to evoke the people around Karen, like basically infantilizing her and controlling her. Also, like, does he have like a spanking thing? Because he also did a short called Dottie Gets Spanked.
Maybe.
Which
maybe that's where it comes from. It's Todd being like, you know, it's the Tarantino, you know, foot shot thing.
Yeah, maybe.
I didn't have much context for this going in, but speaking of a woman with problems, because I think to your point, Jen, this is about presenting an image that looks effortless, but only because it takes so much work to look that way. If you know, if you want to talk about the feminine mystique.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to be like, you know, maybe Karen for not understanding, as I don't think anyone else did at the time. It's like you have to be, you know, a Madonna level cast iron bitch to like get through this unscathed. Which is why kind of like anyone that you know, admire who is also successful at what they do, it's like at their core, they're probably not the person you think they are. Not, it's like, you know, you shouldn't meet your heroes because you only understand them from their success. You don't, you aren't familiar with the, I don't know, the venal work that has to be done, the lengths they have to go to protect themselves in this just to get where they are. It's I'm gonna mess up the quote, but it was, you know, taken from another movie. Hey listeners, write in
info that, at haveyouseen.us.
yeah that was often a great man is not a good man. So I think that that's the naivete that the Carpenters had going into this, is that it isn't any one person. It isn't, you know, despite, you know, Todd Haynes' expressionistic sequence of sort of a deal with the devil with the, you know, what's it, A&M record executive. I think they're all well-meaning people that are part of a diseased system that like no one person is, you can point to and be like, oh, it was Karen's mom who sucked. Oh, it was Karen's brother who was mean. Oh, it was the rapacious music executive. It was all of them with a part to play in this tragic story of like no one of them being the problem, but all of them contributing in ways that they would not acknowledge because their perspective on it is just one part of this larger puzzle that only after the fact you go, oh, this situation was kind of fucked up because it led to, you know, a promising young woman. Watch our episode on Promising Young Woman where we trash that one too, where it's like only after the fact where we're like, oh, it turns out that maybe this isn't healthy to be this driven or to expect this much of one person. Especially to like, can you be perfect all the time in front of everyone? And Karen's like, just let me stop eating. I think I can probably manage it.
Right. I really think that Well, this movie does have kind of, like I said earlier, the trappings of the cliche music biopic, and that might have something to do with the characters that are presented as villains in this. I think he's getting beyond just the people surrounding Karen or the music industry. It really does seem to be something unique to America, like our own particular cultural sickness that he's trying to evoke with Barbie, with the well-stocked shelves of the grocery store, with the easily available pharmaceuticals, the malaise at the top. Oh, wait, that was Carter.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, like I was saying earlier in the episode, it's a nation in denial about what strife is sort of roiling underneath. And it's like, well, I don't want to face, you know, what the Who is saying. I just want to listen to music that tells me it's going to be all right.
Instead of hope I die before I get old.
Right. Yeah. Things like that.
Right. Man, now I want to listen to Quadrophenia. But anyway, did I tell you about the time I blocked someone on Twitter for saying that Quadrophenia sucked?
Good. You made the right decision.
Yeah. No, I really think I did. But yeah, I guess it's it sounds corny to say, like, well, that's Nixon's America, but I think that's what the film is really getting at. And it's jaundiced portrayal of an American family that was kind of nice on the surface, and they were embodied in their very nice son and daughter. But these people eventually kind of broke under the pressure they were put under, the pressure of having to maintain this image. And for Karen, it also came along with, you know, all the baggage of American womanhood, because and if you look into biographical information about Karen Carpenter, she was really more of a tomboy growing up. She loved playing sports. She loved baseball and, like, baseball statistics. She really preferred playing the drums to being the girl singer. And she was a damn good drummer. Like, she got praise from other drummers in the industry, not just for her voice, but also for skill on the kit. And
So she was a really talented musician, but it's like there's also the career aspect of it that goes with it.
And that's a whole other thing. But like, absolutely. But for her, I think that, and this might also be why I personally find the story of the Carpenter so fascinating, particularly Karen, is as someone who herself wore femininity with great difficulty for a lot of her life. I really identify with that, where you get old enough where you're like, oh, like, I don't know if I'm happy just like being the tomboy anymore. Like, I kind of want to like be a woman, but I don't really know where to start.
Right. Yeah. And that's the difficulty with that is, you know, even like on the masculine side, it would be, you know, if I could only fix Karen Carpenter, you know, to be like, well, yeah, maybe you're a tomboy and maybe you're, you know, way too into, you know, the drums and not doing like traditionally feminine things. But it's like, well, by nature of what you do, by nature of you being a woman, that is necessarily feminine. Like you're being a woman correctly just by the nature of doing what you do. And it was a, like, this was, you know, this definitely applies to, you know, masculinity in its very, you know, restricted range of what is acceptable masculinity. But this philosophy was presented to me by, it was on the Australia subreddit, and someone's like, hey, I'm a new, you know, newly minted Australian citizen. You know, they're from, like, I don't know, Southeast Asia. But it's like, well, how do I be more Australian? How do I integrate better? How do I, you know, make myself more of an Australian? And, you know, the people there are like, mate, you're an Australian. Whatever you do is Australian. And I'm like, you know, Anya, you legend. Like, that's, it's self-fulfilling. It's saying that, you know, by nature of what you are, that defines the thing. You're Australian, ergo, the things you do are Australian. You're, you know, Karen Carpenter, you're a tomboy who's into sports and playing the drums. That's what women do. That's what you're into.
Yeah, and I think that's what a self-actualized person right. would ideally yeah. realize. Like, as men and women, and I know that the perception is like, well, you know, women are and men are what they do, and there's that
mm-hmm.
pressure yeah. on men to achieve. And with women, supposedly, like, you are embodied fully as a woman with menarche. But I think for both sexes, we're so hard on ourselves because of the pressures that we get from society. You know, in Karen Carpenter's case, it was like, oh, like, you know, I kind of got fat thighs. Like, I should do something about that. Like, if I just got rid...
That's true. Forget everything I said. That's true.
Yeah, like, and, you know, that is the mindset of the eating disordered person. It's like, if I just get this fat under control, then everything mm-hmm. will be fixed.
Right.
And I think that's a very human quality to be like, you know, just this one thing, like, hey, if I, you know, change my career and then everything mm-hmm. would be great. Or like, if I meet the right person and get married,
yeah.
things will be perfect.
If I just do 200 of these episodes and after that, we might be pretty good. We might be ready to do like a real podcast.
No! The pressure! The pressure! Yeah.
But we are fortunate in that we've never been successful, so we can just continue to be ourselves.
Yeah, we can pretty much do whatever the fuck we want, and that's what we're doing right now.
Yeah, Jen just, like, telling people fuck off online. It's, yeah, we're very self-actualized because we have nothing to lose.
That's because I embody the new American woman who is
right,
just
yes.
an unpleasant bitch all the time.
Yeah, Jen, you are incredibly feminine in that regard.
Woo! Yeah, like... And I like your philosophy, Tim. I think that is really true. Like,
well, yeah, you can go to Australia and you can be like, you know.
Just don't be a right cunt.
Right, yeah, yeah. Be a top cunt, don't be a dog cunt. It's,
yeah.
It's very simple.
As long as you're not there to fuck spiders.
Right, oh, the worst. Oh, they get so offended. I'm making that up.
Also, that pretty little octopus with the blue spots on it, don't put that in a bucket.
Yeah, don't put that in your mouth.
Put it in your mouth. Put it in your mouth. Oh, well, we already did our Singapore Sling episode. Anyway, wow, like,
right.
That's a weird contrast. Like,
yeah.
The excess of Singapore Sling, like all those gross dining scenes.
I cannot eat anything soft after watching that.
Yeah, that and then, like, the very tightly controlled dollhouse world of Superstar, where it's uh-huh. like a little doll, like, with a little tiny box of laxatives. Yeah,
fine.
It's the full spectrum of eating and disgorging.
Right, so who killed Karen Carpenter? Society did.
Damn, bro, that's so true.
I know. Yeah, it was the grind.
Yep. I don't know. You got much else to say, Tim? Because, like, I feel like I talked to Blue Street.
Not about Karen Carpenter, but I do think it's interesting that Todd Haynes also directed Safe.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is on a similar topic. It is a woman who has this nebulous, indefinable disorder, but she's dealing with the symptoms, not the cause. And if you don't understand why you feel, like, wrong, like, why something feels scary or bad, like, you're never going to figure out, you're never going to solve it. You're never going to figure out what is causing this because you're just reacting to, you know, the manifest symptoms of it, not the underlying cause. So Julianne Moore in Safe, Karen Carpenter in America in the 1970s, you can only react to symptoms as they arise, but you'll never know what the cause is because you aren't equipped to understand where these problems come from. They're too multivariant, they're too big for any one person to understand, let alone someone who's trying to maintain a squeaky clean image while working with her brother and trying to be a top pop star and also dealing with family issues and an unsatisfying marriage and all the other things that go along with being a human being. Ask that of anyone. They can't do it.
It occurs to me that, like, a lot of the greatest Hollywood directors,
mm-hmm.
Todd Haynes excels at portraying feminine pain.
Yeah. It's, you know, the beleaguered feminism gets, you know, new life under a man's leadership. Was that Onion article?
Well, I think because, and this, like, it's a clumsy way to say it, but, you know, I mean, women and queer people get lumped together all the time anyway as the other.
And yeah, yeah.
Todd Haynes also makes,
and you have everyone else.
Yeah, and Todd Haynes also makes movies about the queer experience, and mm-hmm. so I think he's just kind of tuned into that. I did have the privilege of telling Todd Haynes in person how much I loved Safe, and
great.
He seemed like, oh, well, wow, thank you. Because I think the way I put it was like, that movie changed the way I think about film.
Mm.
Which is true. When I saw it, it blew my tiny mind. I love that movie. It's on Tubi right now, folks. If you haven't seen it, go watch it.
Yeah, it's probably on archive.org as well. The dumping ground for relevant art.
Yeah, you can see Superstar, The Karen Carpenter Story on archive.org currently. I do want to mention that apparently it has been restored via the collaboration of UCLA and Sundance. This came from Christine Vachon, the indie producer.
Good, because it is like watching through soup.
Yeah, it looks
VHS copy.
It looks
online.
Really bad. And I know there have been screenings of the movie, like an actual like first generation copy of it, like on 16. I have not had the privilege of attending one of those. I would really love to go to one just to say that I had done it. But we are closer than we've ever been to a possible actual release of Superstar. Maybe not soon, but we're getting closer to it.
Yeah.
For what it's worth.
And for better or worse, watching Superstar, I think like the closest experience to that is the episode the movie that we cover in one of our earlier episodes, the Nine Inch Nails Broken movie, because that is watching, you know, a fifth generation VHS copy where it's like, you kind of got to like rewind through and be like, what did I just see? What was that?
Yeah. So, and also in its way, a movie about suburban anguish.
Right. Yeah. Because even the end of it, after Karen has died, we get more of the same from before, which is just these shots trucking past suburban houses and supermarkets, and it's this very indifferent, anonymous suburban tableau. They're like, hey, everything's fine here. Well, not really.
We're all having a great time in Downey.
Yeah, we're listening to the Carpenters, we're watching Blue Velvet.
Everything we're fucked is up fine. On Quaaludes.
Yeah, yeah. It's morning in America. That comes later.
Oh, God. Yeah, and that's the thing is, you know, I mean, you know, and Superstar came out in 1987, but, mm-hmm. you know, when the Carpenters were around, that was what we were careening toward.
Yeah.
And I guess in their way, like, the Carpenters are kind of a Republican-ass band. I'm sure Richard Carpenter is a fucking Republican. Mike Kerb, who, the music guy and producer who actually dated Karen for a while, he was a Republican lieutenant governor of California back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah, not to denigrate their musical, you know, achievements, but it does, the Carpenters... My take on them, you know, in 2024 is it is a conservative ethos behind affinity for the Carpenters, where it is amidst everything else, you're like, everything's fine. You know, Return with a V. yeah, let's just have nice music about nice things.
Yeah, forget all these like native plants. Let's go back to manicured lawns.
Right, yeah. Everything is square and neat, and I know everyone in my neighborhood, and if I don't, I post on Nextdoor, and then I call the cops. So, yeah, you want to talk about fascism, you know, controlling its own victim. There it is.
Yeah,
it's the straitjacket of performative gender and so many other things.
Yeah, I mean, it might be an awkward student film, but it still has relevance today.
Yeah, and I think we did it justice with this discussion.
We tried.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you can get 2 extra episodes every month, plus access to our growing catalog of reviews for just $5 a month by going to patreon.com and searching for Have You Seen This? You never do anything nice
hey,
and quickly.
Hey.
What?
Hey.
Hey. What?
Hey, you know what? Schling, schling a schlong.
I love Vanilla Ice's cover of the Carpenters catalog.